Hello, everyone. Another sort of offshoot area I've been wanting to do for a long, long time, and I'm finally going to do it. And I'm recording these in advance, not doing them live because there's so many and they're quite long. So I will be recording each lesson in this series. And it's something quite dear to my heart and something I was very much involved with many, many years ago. And I was just out watering the garden then and just realized that I really stopped being involved when I started having my children because my focus moved from myself to my kids. And, but periodically on and off, I have been following these concepts for a very long time. And this is a very old set of lessons, and it's all about the lessons of life science or natural hygiene. So I will be narrating all of the lessons from TC Fry's lessons on life science, beginning today with the introduction into life science. I am quite an accomplished water faster. Basically, all I learned about water fasting was through these lessons and how to be able to handle them, without any major difficulty as far as needing to be supervised or essentially worrying anybody in the family and things like that from when I fast. We'll get to water fasting. It's one of the marvelous lessons in this very long ago written, I guess it's a book, but it's a book of lessons. So today I'm going to start with the introduction into life science, and I will just, as I always do, I thought I was organized. I just have to find my PDF, and it looks like it disappeared. Just before, it's okay. We've got plenty of time. I've had this for a long time. I actually signed up to do this course as a kind of like a, it was kind of like a university course many years ago. And I'm talking many, many, many years ago. And as I said, I'd already had one child and she was still very little, but I kind of stopped once she started getting older and we all get involved in things with our kids, so that's what happened. And so I'll try that again. And I'm actually not going to share it. I'm going to actually read it out to you. And eventually, I will give you each of the links to the PDF file. Okay, so what is life science? So, at the outset, it is wise to delineate just what life science is, just what grounds it covers. Life as we know it is possible. And became possible because certain favorable conditions were are and were present. Some of these conditions include favorable temperature, presence of oxygen and other gases and minerals, presence of water, absence of lethal substances, etc. Life science is the study of all the conditions which make life possible. Because present-day life seems to be losing touch with those conditions which made life possible. Life science brings us back to our roots, or so to speak. We should endeavor to meet life's requisites so that we can lead a joyous existence. Science is not the cold, dispassionate pursuit many of us have been led to believe. Rather, it is personal and relevant to all that we are involved in. When we turn our studies upon ourselves so that we may have a very personal science, we begin to arrive at the essence of life science. Science, as represented today, is not the warm, practical medium we speak of here. Science that we can't use and benefit is hardly science. Life science is the exploration and elaboration of those elements and influences we can invoke to exalt our lives and being. Certain truths are applicable to our being. Studying and systemizing these truths so that we can be guided by them is our aim here. That which begets correct results is scientific. That which begets wrong results is unscientific. Life science concerns itself with those principles and truths applicable to human life so that we may observe and avail ourselves of them. We are of the firm conviction that only by scientific living can we realize the loftiest joys and the destiny which is our birthright. Animals in nature are creatures of instinct. Following the guidance of instinct, they are correctly self-directed to meet their needs. Thus, they thrive optimally in accord with their environmental possibilities. Inborn guidance is, in effect, life science, or a science of life for nature's creatures. Humans have infinitely more potential for happiness and goodness than nature's simpler forms of life. We are endowed with immeasurably more sophisticated faculties. These superior endowments can keep us in a state of euphoria during a long life. Life science must be for humans what inborn direction is for animals. We too have instincts, but we are far more than just as than these basic impulses of life. Unfortunately, we not only fail to follow our instincts, but we often reject them in our living practices. Our instincts have been vitiated and perverted by unwholesome conditioning in a world that is quite berserk by sane standards. When humans act contrary to instincts, they are being unscientific. When their practices are in accord with their instincts, with their inherent biological adaptations, they are living scientifically. Life science is as simple as that. Obeying our natural instincts is part and parcel of life science. We believe nature did not err in instilling in us guiding instincts. We contend that humans, with our as yet fledging intellects, do the erring that begets our sickness and suffering. Life science is an intellectual endeavor. We are far along enough that we can determine what is good and what is bad for us. We are profound enough in our knowledge to construct a science of life that will guide us to realize the happiness and the destiny that should be ours. Life science is therefore a way of life that rightfully concerns itself in every facet of human life and human well-being. Only such a thoroughgoing philosophy and concern can be a true science of life. In introducing life science as a true philosophy of life thoroughly in accord with the facts of existence, the question arises as to how its validity was determined. The surest way of assessing the correctness of any system is to put it to the test. Does it work? If it works, it must be deemed valid. If it does not work, then it must be unscientific. Life science began with success. From its beginning as a new, but not yet complete, healing science, it developed until today. It is a full-blown scientific system touching upon everything that relates to human well-being. That is valid. And that it is valid is beyond doubt. Life science works perfectly. To capture the essence of the science of healthful living, I feel it appropriate to quote from the most notable hygienist, Dr. Keki Sidwa. He's been a hygienic practitioner in Great Britain for almost 20 years. And quote, in spite of all the great advances in many branches of science, we are still in a period of prehistory, a dark age in our thinking about health, disease and healing. What the world sorely needs is a new concept of health, a different orientation of thoughts, words and deeds than we have been led to accept for umpteen generations, is now urgently called for. One moment. Sorry about that. I'm getting croaky in the throat and I need to pause for a moment. There we go. Yeah, I got a little croaky throat and I couldn't stop it. Natural hygiene, a life science, is that branch of biology which investigates the conditions upon which health depends and the means by which it may be sustained in all its virtue and purity while we have it, and restored when it is lost or impaired. Before physiology developed, the rules of hygiene were instinctive, traditional, and empirical. Today, these rules are based on the growing knowledge of physiology and biology. If we had perfect knowledge of the laws of life and applied them in a perfect system of hygiene, disease would be impossible and never occur. In this sense, hygiene is the science of intellect and healthy living. Natural hygiene refutes the present day ideas that disease and ill health are inevitable in people's lives. Just make sure my volume is okay. Yeah. Depending on chance and circumstances outside their own control and domain. Natural hygiene is a way of life, a philosophy of living. Health can only be obtained through healthful living. It cannot be bought across the counter from a drugstore, nor can it be found in a physician's office or in a hospital. We contend that healing is a biological process which is continuously going on inside every organism. This brilliant expression of the hygienic stand by Dr. Sidwar deserves immortality. His salutary contributions to the science of healthful living will achieve immortality in our annals. Certainly, this statement embodies the essence of hygienic philosophy. The following is a concise statement of the philosophy, principles and practices of life science. Okay. Just get myself comfy here. Life science holds that life should be meaningful and filled with beauty, goodness, and happiness. Life science holds that humans are inherently good, righteous, and virtuous, and that their exalted character will be realized under ideal life conditions. Life science holds that superlative well-being is normal to human existence and necessary to the realization of the highest human ideals. Life science holds that extreme human excellence can be realized only in those who embrace those precepts and practices which are productive of well-being. Life science, which encompasses all that bears upon human well-being, constitutes the only way to realize the highest possible order of human existence. Life science alone is in harmony with nature, in accord with the principles of vital organic existence, correct in science, sound in philosophy and ethics, in agreement with common sense and successful in practice and a blessing to humankind. Life science recognizes that the human body is fully self-sufficient organism, that it is self-directing, self-constructing, self-preserving and self-healing, and that it is capable of maintaining itself in superb functioning order, completely free of disease, if its needs are met. Foremost, among these needs are fresh air, pure water, rest and sleep, wholesome foods, cleanliness, comfortable temperature, sunshine, exercise, constructive work, emotional poise, self-mastery, recreation and pleasant environment. Life science recognizes that humans are constitutionally adapted to a diet of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds, eaten in compatible combinations while in the fresh, raw, natural state. Life science recognizes that disease are caused by improper life practices, especially dietary indiscretions. Illness proceeds from reduced nerve energy and consequent toxemia. Insufficient nerve energy arises from dissipation, stress, overindulgence, excess, or deficiency of the normal essentials of life, or pollution of the body with substances not normal to it. Accordingly, recovery from sickness can be achieved only by discontinuing its causes and supplying conditions favorable to healing. Life science recognizes that a thoroughgoing rest, which includes fasting, is the most favorable condition under which an ailing body can purify and repair itself. Life science, which teaches that exalted well-being can be attained and maintained only through biologically correct living practices, is not in any sense a healing art or curing cult. It regards as mistaken and productive of much grief the idea that diseases can be prevented or overcome by agencies abnormal to our natural being. Consequently, life science emphatically rejects all drugs, medications, vaccinations, and treatments because they undermine health by interfering with or destroying vital body processes and tissues. Therefore, life science regards the body and the mind as the inviolable sanctuary of an individual's being. Life science holds that everyone has an inalienable right to have a pure and uncontaminated body, to be free of abnormal compulsions and restraints, and to be free to meet his or her needs as a responsible member of society. The concept of innate individual worth. Life science holds that we are born naturally innocent and naturally good. The first two paragraphs of the concise statement we had heretofore printed in Exposition of Life Sciences, Philosophies, Principles and Practices states this. Scientific studies of babies and youngsters have pointed to one inescapable conclusion. As gregarious creatures, humans are naturally empathetic, altruistic, and moral, i.e. humans are naturally righteous toward one another in keeping in their gregarious instinct. Humans are woefully perverted by unnatural conditions within the context of civilization. They are made vicious by inhumane influences such as deceptive practices, exploitation, insecurity, and other baneful conditions in a society gone mad. Individuals usually strive to present the appearance of an upright character to others. This bespeaks our innate urge and conviction that we should be righteous. Life science holds that if a society of assurance exists, these innate virtues will assert themselves naturally. The concept of happiness and ideal of health as normal. Life science holds that life was developed to be a long, joyous event from birth until a natural death. Happiness and health flow from ideal life conditions. Ideal life conditions are normal in the environments of our development. However, such is the human intelligence that it has made almost all environments over the face of the globe inhabitable. Many arts, artifices, and artificial environments have been created to satisfactorily supplant the wonders, beauties, and beneficence of a natural environment in many habitats. Though, in truth, such artifices are never completely wholesome substitutes. Life science holds that humans developed to their high state because they adapted so well to the environment and its possibilities. This means that health is normal and natural when the conditions to which we were adapted are met. Superb excellence in humans flows from ideal life conditions and the superlative health begotten of them. The self-evident concept of self-government in all organisms. Simple observation of the development of complex organisms from the union of sperm and ovum is indicative that the powers of life reside inside. Without anything from the outside other than needed raw materials, the organism has the inner direction to fashion itself from a fertilized ovum into a mature adult. This implies an inherent character that embraces the following capabilities. Organisms are self-programmed. Organisms are self-directing or self-governing. Organisms are self-sufficient when their material requisites are available. Organisms are self-constructing in accord with their genetic blueprint. Organisms are self-defensive and preservative, defending themselves against all internal and external threats. Organisms are self-repairing or self-healing and possess solely and exclusively the faculties and powers to accomplish restoration in event of damage or derangement. These faculties and powers are self-evident upon the simplest observation of yourself or other organisms. This concept and its axioms should ever be borne in mind when dealing with clients. Remember, this is a lessons course, so we're talking about people learning to become life science practitioners. The confidence needed in dealing with your own problems, should you have any, or with the problems of your clients, can be derived and reinforced by referring to these self-evident truths. Life science is a new concept of healthful living. Life science may be said to be a reassertion of the conditions best suited to a human life in pristine nature. Humans lived what they now call life science because of primal urges on an instinctual level. They lived as gatherers of fruits from vine, stalk, and tree. With the development of intellect, humans became ever more versatile in dealing with the forces of nature. But this eventually led to human alienation from both nature and our biological heritage. Though most humans observed much of their pristine endowment well into the civilization of the Christian era, the Dark Ages of medieval times brought on the renunciation of nature and earthly considerations. Humans became poorer in the observation of the elementary needs of life. Human needs on earth were contravened in the name of religion and salvation. Fortunately, the Dark Ages did not wipe out mankind. Near the end of the Dark Ages, the unnatural and inhumane conditions under which European civilization lived decimated the population with plagues. Great plagues were not due to any kind of contagion. The only thing contagious in the times of the bubonic and black plagues was widespread modes of death-dealing living practices. Hygiene or life science as a philosophy and outlook survived the Dark Ages when the twin human scourges of medical and religious superstition saddled most of what we refer to smugly as the civilized world. In many parts of the world, our biological mandate was fairly well maintained, notably in tropical cultures of the Far East and in isolated pockets here and there. It was preserved among many traditions and cultures in part. Well before the Christian era, Pythagoras elaborated a rather extensive philosophy of living on all planes of life. Among them was perhaps the best formulated statement of hygienic living until this time. While the Greeks, of whom Pythagoras was one, were heavy on fruitarianism, they were also heavy into the insipid practices that begot the modern Goliath of medicine. The philosophy of Pythagoras gave rise to Apollonius and Essenes, an ascetic culture that was vegetarian, fruitarian in practice. Much of Essenian philosophy and practices were preserved in the New Testament and is quoted in the sayings of Christ. The thin thread of hygienic philosophy survived and received a modern impetus from the greatest universal genius of all time, Leonardo da Vinci, who was a vegetarian fruitarian. Though medical beliefs remained relatively unscathed while the area of religious domination were receding during the Renaissance, some elements of the hygienic philosophy survived. I reiterate that our natural heritage was largely unaffected by the medical outlook in many areas of the world, notably in the Far East. But healthful living as a philosophy of life in the Western culture did not exist as such. It was not until the time of Dr. Isaac Jennings in 1822 that hygiene as a formalized philosophy of life had its beginnings. Not until the consummate genius of Drs. Graham, Traill, Dewey, Tilden, and Shelton did the philosophy and science of health become fully ascertained. Life science is not new from many perspectives, although it is relatively new to what we call civilization. But it is totally new for most who learn it for the first time. Now it is alien to our culture because of its relative rarity. At this time, life science, even though in accord with our pristine being, is in eclipse because of medical thinking and a commerce that trades upon pathogenic fare. It is our hope to teach enough dedicated individuals this science of health to assure that humanity thrives in health and enlightenment. In pursuing this course, you are asked to be the torchbearers of a way of life whose time has come. Sorry, I got itchy. Life science is a broad-based science of life. By no means is life science confined to dietary principles, as you might gather from association with today's hygienists. Few hygienists involve themselves with the expansive aspects of life science as a philosophy, embracing every facet of human well-being. Dietary concerns are but one area of life science dominion. It also includes mental and emotional well-being, as well as social and economic well-being. It includes environmental factors or ecology and is coextensive with all factors that touch upon human welfare. While this course is not nominally on the specific area of nutrition, nutrition is but a small part of the all-encompassing philosophy of life science. The concept of health healing, self-healing or self-repair. Self-healing is the only healing. Throughout nature, we see animals with cuts, bruises, broken bones and other injuries undergo healing. Obviously, this healing is affected by internal faculties and powers. For in nature, animals seek out a quiet, secluded spot and rest. They undergo almost no activity. They partake of no food. Instinctively, an injured animal will abstain from all indulgences that detract from the full application of the body's energies and faculties to the reparative, restorative process. Likewise, humans, when placed under the same conditions in keeping with our nature and disposition, undergo healing in a fraction of the time that occurs when regular activities are pursued. Healing is always and ever a biological process. Our task is but to establish the conditions so that the body may conduct the process more quickly and efficiently. The inherent programming, intelligence, and power that developed a fertilized ovum into a wonderfully and beautifully built creature is all the healing power that is needed. Conditions favorable to the exercise of these powers can be established. As a health practitioner nutritionist, it will be your role to know and apply these conditions. Much suffering and grief result from the idea that the body can be helped by the application of substances, conditions, and treatments abnormal to the body. It will be your role to rescue the victims from harmful practices as well as set them on the right course for health recovery and maintenance. This, I love this part. And there's a lot of you who will know what I mean. The concept of individual sovereignty. Life science holds that everyone is an independent entity unto himself or herself within the context of society. Everyone should be entirely free, fettered in no way, within the context of enlightened self-interest, within the context of our symbiotic mandate on earth. Every man, woman, and child must be regarded as capable of carrying on life's affairs for himself or herself. It is not our role to judge or impose others on matters, but to help if our aid is sought. We should not impose ourselves on anyone, no matter how wise or unwise, or how bad, good or bad such imposition is or would be. We must accord to everyone the prerogative of leading their lives as is their bent and capability, so long as their pursuits do not impinge upon the birthright of others. The golden rule should be our rule of conduct. While it may seem unwise to grant the same privileges and prerogatives to both the genius and the relatively unlettered, nevertheless, a society is not free in which either are denied their right to pursue opportunities on an equal footing. The capable are bound to succeed and should offer aid to their biologically crippled or less favoured brethren. For all its drawbacks and advantages, we must always respect everyone as supremely sovereign. Whatever they do or decide, however good or bad their acts or decisions, in their own interests, we must pursue a role of non-interference. We may, by example, seek to inspire and motivate, but to impose ourselves and our precepts on others is reprehensible. A discussion on the medical approach to health and disease. The erroneous notion of cure. The idea behind medicine is more than 2,500 years old, and like most ideas from behind the Dark Ages, it's very unscientific. The premise is that the body is like a machine that can be repaired by outside agencies. The machine goes wrong because of invading entities. In ancient times, these entities were evil spirits, demons, and devils, which had to be exorcised. By and by, these evil spirits became known as little beasties called microbes, germs, bacteria, viruses, and yet other appellations. Medicine today has the concept of cure, a word that has been perverted from the original of care. Medicine itself means a curative or healing substance. The idea behind the use of medicine is that medicine acts within the organism, that it seeks out the trouble, routs out the invaders, and affects in some manner the necessary healing. The medical concept of the modus operandi of drugs, which they call medicines, is very hazy at best, but medicine is the harmful practices that men do to try to help ailing people. People go to physicians for medical intervention. They want to get fixed up. They're ailing. Something must be done lest they suffer grave consequences or death. Medical practitioners take advantage of their clients. They play on their fears. They applaud their clients for coming to them when they did. They flatter them for this bit of wisdom and assure them that if they do not do something soon, grave dangers will ensue. The medical man always has a course of treatment to suggest, invariably a prescription of drugs and tests. The idea is that tests will reveal what is wrong and thereby determine what drugs to prescribe and what steps to take, as in surgery. That their beliefs and practices are, on the whole, precisely contrary to biological science seems never to enter their minds. We'll treat medical concepts in depth at a later time, but here, suffice to say, there is no healing other than self-healing. All modalities can interfere with healing, but none can aid healing. Cures do not deal with causes. Can you imagine trying to develop a drug to cure drunkenness without going to the root of the whole matter, i.e. the drunkard's drinking habit? How can we deal with drunkenness if the drunkard continues to drink? This is what happens with their medical approach. They try to remedy effects or symptoms without dealing with the causes. In reality, they drug, butcher, and purge while almost totally ignoring basic causes of psychological problems. They resort to crippling surgery and treatments running into thousands of dollars when the problems can be simply and inexpensively solved by a change in life practices. We'll learn herein that nothing happens without sufficient cause. You'll learn that all affections of the body must be caused and the cause is almost always initiated by the sufferer. You'll learn that unless cause is discontinued, the problem will always develop again, ever more serious. In learning nutritional and health science, you're basically learning to do two things. One, to remove causes of problems, and two, to establish the conditions of health. Since these two steps are so very easy overall, that is one reason we can confidently bestow upon you a degree of Doctor of Philosophy at the end of these lessons. If you've mastered the understanding of cause and effect in nutrition and health, that diseases are suffered because the sufferer has indulged or been subjected to cause, and that health results when reasons for health are dominant, you'll be a mountain among a throng of molehills called healthcare professionals. Just a moment. The joys of the family around while you're trying to record. Incredible. Okay, continuing on. Cures do not furnish the needs of life. To be returned to the healthy body. I'll start again. To be returned to health, the body must be provided with its requirements. First, those substances, influences and practices which beget illnesses and disease must be discontinued. Secondly, it is necessary to bring to the client the essentials of health. Very simply, these are pure air, pure water, correct diet, sunshine, exercise or wholesome activity, adequate rest and sleep, emotional poise, security of life and its means, and yet other factor elements and influences. If you reflect upon medical procedures, it is obvious that they do not try to ascertain causes that are inherent in lifestyle and practices. They do what an auto mechanic does. They try to find out which cylinder is missing and then proceed as if the body can be repaired much in the manner of a vehicle. They rarely advise about practices and beliefs which cause problems. Since most medical men are financially orientated, it is wise that they do not teach correct habits. They'd be out of business if their clients became well. Cures destroy body vitality. Dr. Herbert M. Shelton must be proclaimed the highest oracle of hygienic philosophy, principles and practices unto this day. He has noted that now we have more medical discoveries than ever before. We have more medical practitioners than ever before. Medical men enjoy more respect than ever before, at least until recent years. And yet, for all of this, we also have more disease and suffering than ever before. Why is this so? Because very simply, drugs destroy. They never build. It is not within the province of drugs to create cells and replace body tissue. Medical men would be the first to tell you this, for they studied physiology too. But yet they act as if the drugs perform some kind of magic that will affect healing. What do drugs, when administered, really do? In truth, drugs do nothing other than form chemical unions within body compounds and fluids. When these chemical unions occur, the body suffers distress. When the character of a substance is determined as harmful by the body, it goes into a frenzy. When it does this, it is stimulated. Sometimes the body has a reaction of depression, in which case it is sedated or narcoticized. This means function has been inhibited or paralyzed. In both cases, the reaction is one of self-protection against an unwelcome intruder. In this case, a poison, even though it is called a medicine. In causing an emergency in the body, drugs are harmful. The body must redirect its energies from the healing process which it is conducting. The symptoms for which the drugs or medicines are administered are evidences of the body's self-conducted healing process. When drugs are ingested or injected, the body must leave off partially or wholly the cleansing healing effects and attend to a greater threat which the drugs represent. When healing effects are discontinued, the symptoms disappear. Physicians interpret the disappearance of symptoms as a cure or a healed condition. Thus, they mistake drug or poison effects for healing effects. In reality, the body has more problems than before. For now it has, additional to its prior problems, the problem of expelling a terrible poison too. Medical and healing art approaches are deadly and dead end. We readily recognize that drug addicts take illicit drugs and eventually become psychological wrecks as a result. Also, the drug addict loses moral values. Thinking inability is lessened and almost totally redirected to acquiring the addictive drugs and to the spell the body casts when they are taken. What we also recognize is that physician prescribed drugs have precisely the same actions. What we do not recognize is that the prescriptions, administrations, and treatments of all so-called healers have the very same effects, whether the medics be called physicians, homeopaths, chiropractors, osteopaths, herbal doctors, acupuncturists, or whatever. Their modalities devitalize while their ignorance of cause likewise continues to devitalize and destroy. Because treatments are more or less deadly and because causes are left intact by those who treat the disease, the situation gets progressively worse. Those who get better do not become so because of the treatments. Better health comes from self-healing, which occurs despite, not because of, treatments. Under medical and other care, recovery takes place about 90% of the time. Medical men, just as do herbologists, chiropractors, osteopaths, etc., attribute healing to their intervention. But the unrecognized truth is that witch doctors have a much higher cure rate and that hygienic practitioners have a nearly 100% recovery rate. As a hygienic practitioner or health professional following the dictates of a true health science, you'll realize a nearly 100% success rate. Healing always takes place to the extent of residual healing potential when causes are discontinued and the conditions of health are instituted. What health really is? Delineation and description of health. Well, can we define health? Yes, we can. Conventionally, a lack of obvious disease is regarded as a state of health. In actuality, about 99% of our peoples are diseased in some manner or other, regardless of appearances. Health may be defined as having fullness of function. Health means complete well-being, inner and outer harmony, vigor, strength, mental acuity, and in short, total fitness. Perhaps no better statement of health has ever been made than that of Dr. Herbert M. Shelton. I'm happy to quote his definition. Health is a condition of perfect development, a state of wholeness and harmonious development and growth, an adaptation of part to part of the organism or organ to organ, and with no part stunted and no part in excess. In this state of organic development lies the perfection and symmetry of beauty. Beauty is but the reflection of wholeness, of health. It is easy to demonstrate that the forms and proportions of humans and every animal and plant which are in their highest and most useful state are the most beautiful and therefore the most healthy. When every bone is of the best form and size for its service in the total organism, there is perfect proportion. When every muscle is fully and proportionately developed with just enough of fat and the cellular tissues to round out the muscles, we have the highest beauty of form. When the texture of the skin is finest, when the circulation of the blood most vigorous, the blood well nourished and freed of all waste, there is a glow and charm of the finest complexion. The highest beauty is the expression of the highest health. Partial beauty, fading beauty, or decaying beauty, these are but expressions of partial, fading, or decaying health. When we suffer any impairment or impediment, we cannot be said to be in a state of health. We can be in a relatively high state of health, but to the extent we do not enjoy perfection of body function, we are not healthy. We live in a nation where disease is the norm of life rather than a rarity. In taking up a health career, it is our duty to make the health, to make health the norm and disease a relative rarity. I refer you to text material included in this lesson for a fuller discussion of what health is. Therein appear two articles by the Dean of Health Teachers, Dr. Herbert M. Shelton. Beauty is a reflecting health. Though our standards of beauty are rather low today, they still nevertheless take note of the exceptionally beautiful. Beauty as a reflection of health and well-being should be the norm, not the exception. How many women have we seen who are so lovely and beautiful that we are drawn to them like as a magnet? How many men are so wholesome, so fit and handsome that they, likewise, are irresistible to their female counterparts? I dare say such men and women constitute less than 1% of our peoples. The ability to appreciate beauty is highest in humans. And humans would normally be the epitome of beauty if they lived in keeping with their birthright, that is, their biological mandate. We readily recognize beauty in birds, flowers, and other life in nature, but our fellow humans, whether aged or young, whether nice or disagreeable, are, for the most part, in some way repulsive to our aesthetic senses. 40% of our population are repulsively overweight, but this is one impact of the ugliness that characterizes an unhealthy population. I've seen monsters transformed as if by magic upon undergoing as little as a month's hygienic care. Fatness and ugliness both were overcome with the restoration of a relatively high level of health. One of the miracles you can hold forth to your would-be clients is that of handsomeness and beauty. That quality will be tremendously enhanced in those whom you help to achieve a high level of health. Fullness of function is a barometer of health. While it is not always true that athletes are superb examples of health, it is true that all in superb health are quite athletic. Subtleness, agility, stamina, strength, and vigor are qualities essential to a state of health. Psychological function will be ideal in every aspect to someone in full health. A sense of euphoria, of joy, and of total well-being is a condition of health. Healthy people usually wear smiles and pleasant countenances. Glumness and a downcast disposition personify inner unhealthiness. Nothing sabotages beauty, function, happiness, and well-being as a body shot through with poisons or toxins born of bad living practices. The possibility of perfect health for humans. Life science holds that perfect health is the norm of life. We hold that all creatures in nature adapted perfectly to the conditions of life under which they developed. They changed to cope with their environment and their food supplies. In nature, perfect health is the norm of existence. Animals have no knowledge or concept about healthy living. They live healthfully, naturally, by doing only what their instincts bid them to do. It would seem that with a technological society at the apex of development, human health would have kept pace and be better now than ever. The contrary is true. Humans are probably unhealthier now than at any time, except the immediate past, that is, the last 10 to 20 centuries. In the Dark Ages and medieval times, health was at an overall low. Technological progress builds upon itself, and it is a credit to the human heritage that we still have, even though in a degenerated state, sufficient intelligence to develop and husband a highly technological society. Even though affected by physical degeneracy, the brain is always the least affected of organs in famine, disease, starvation, and physical debilitation. Perfect health is possible if the conditions of health are ideal. With our intelligence and extensive technology, we can create the conditions for healthful living practically anywhere in the world where humans live. Health is normal and natural. Over eons of time, organisms have developed to cope with changed environmental conditions and food supplies that varied environments were capable of producing. Environments range from the ideal to the impossible for every creature on Earth, even microbial forms of life. Perfection arises from adaptation, from coping and conditions. Adjustments to every vagary of nature created organisms that function perfectly. In humans and animals, we witness what is obvious. Health is normal and natural. We see animals in nature being born, living with their natural lifespans and dying naturally without once suffering the infirmities of sickness. And for all our modern pathogenic practices, we see humans more or less well most of the time. In view of my hygienic experience and my observation of hundreds of others who remain sickness-free under the hygienic regime, there is but one inescapable conclusion. Health is a normal condition of life. It is our birthright. Life science is truly a science of life, for it is based soundly and scientifically upon our biological requirements for thriving in perfect health. This is the overlook which you are studying in this course and being asked to advocate and follow in your professional career. So this is a very, very long lesson. I will read the next part and then I will go to a new video to continue. It might even be three or four videos just for part one. How life science began in modern times. Life science or natural hygiene had its awakening in 1822 when Dr. Isaac Jennings, who had a medical practice in Derby, Connecticut, despaired of drugging. In his many years of practice, he was distressed to see his patients become worse from the drugging modality. His patients died and many became chronically afflicted. His yearning to help his fellow beings was sincere. Dr. Jennings noted that as physicians became older, they drugged less and less. He did likewise and found his patients were faring better under less drugging. Then he quit prescribing drugs altogether and found that it wrought miracles. When patients with problems came to Dr. Jennings, he would dispense pills of coloured flour and vials of tinted water. He gave strict instructions for their use, as other physicians gave detailed instructions for the ingestion of drugs. But in Dr. Jennings' case, he made a prescription that was to launch a great health movement and an infant science. In 1822, at the age of 34, Dr. Jennings gave his patients placebos with instructions to take them at specified hours of the day with a glass of water. His prescription was that no food could be taken or these pills would not work. His patients were ordered to do this for a number of days and then return for a checkup. Upon their return, they would be terminated from the regime or continued on it for a few more days. Under Dr. Jennings's new modality, his patients invariably became well. While other physicians lost patients by the graveyard full, his thrived. The ailing flocked to him from far and near. The success of his no-drugging system astounded Dr. Jennings as much as it did his patients and colleagues. Wisely, in his initial years, Dr. Jennings did not reveal his secrets. Instead, he sought the rationale for success. He called his treatments the leave alone method while professing to dispense pills of unnamed composition. They came to be regarded as pills with magic curative properties. From this rather inauspicious start, Dr. Jennings began to develop a few laws relative to his observations and experience. He called the system that flowed from the employment of these laws orthopathy, or correct affection. He formulated many of the laws of life and named some of them as follows. The laws of action and repose, i.e. the necessity for activity and rest, sleep. The law of economy, which resulted from his observation of the way in which the body managed its vital energies. The law of physiological distribution, or the way in which the body supplies all its parts and faculties adequately. The law of stimulation, or how the body accelerates its physiological activities at a frenzied level when a toxic material is introduced therein. The law of accommodation, or how the body adjusts to poisons by decreasing its vital resistance and more effectively quarantining itself from the toxins' baneful influences. The body gradually builds defensive mechanisms, much as armies grow to ward off attack as the need becomes greater. The law of limitation, or the conversion of vital energies. The law of equilibrium, or the revitalization of debilitated parts and faculties when normalcy has been restored in an ailing organism. Dr. Jennings, to his credit, saw disease not as an attack from some malevolent entity, but as a lowered vital energy, or vital energy redirected to other purposes. His new outlook ventured that disease was caused by an ebb of the body's energy supply. In essence, he was correct, but his explanations were quite formative, for it remained for successors to build upon the foundations he built. Dr. Jennings may rightfully be ascribed as the father of natural hygiene or life science, for he is the first to attempt a systematic ascertainment of the physiology of health and disease. The next illustrious forefather of the science of health was Sylvester Graham. He was born 6 years after Dr. Jennings in 1794. He was a very sickly boy. Becoming healthy was an obsession with him, which led him to study health. He became well-versed in anatomy and physiology. Before coming onto the health scene, he was a Presbyterian preacher. In 1830, during the temperance movement, he lectured in Philadelphia on the physiological effects of alcohol. As a firebrand orator, he was amazingly effective with large audiences. Sorry, I've got a little tickle in my throat. In Philadelphia, he explained his knowledge of physiology and health and became acquainted with the teachings of a vegetarian group who abstained from animal foods and products and many modern ways of preparing foods. This group was known as the Bible Christian Church and based its mode of life on biblical commands. In the great cholera epidemic of 1832, Sylvester Graham rose to fame. He literally took on the whole medical fraternity of New York City and the interests supporting the medical system. While the medical men were advising New Yorkers to abstain from fruit and to cook their food thoroughly, Dr. Graham was advocating eating more fruits in the raw state. He advocated open windows, more light and fresh air, and other healthful measures, which were contrary to medical teachings. It is noteworthy that those who followed Dr. Graham's teachings were not affected by the cholera epidemic, whereas those who followed medical bidding died wholesale. His fame as a health lecturer was well established in 1832, and he, more than anyone else, gave health science a tremendous impetus. He was in demand as a lecturer over the whole eastern seaboard. He appeared before audiences of several thousand people. People flocked to his lectures and listened to them raptly for hours in seeking salvation from disease and suffering. So effective was Dr. Sylvester Graham in his lectures and writings that books and magazines blossomed presenting the Graham system. The first health food stores came into existence to sell foods which he advocated. Special eateries and living facilities were established for those who wanted to follow his system. The name of Graham became synonymous with the hygienic diet and hygienic living. When Dr. Isaac Jennings approached health and healing from the point of view of helping people regain health, Dr. Sylvester Graham was instrumental in teaching the touchstones of healthy living so that people would not become ill in the first place. During the 1840s, Dr. Jennings and Dr. Graham were joined by perhaps one of the greatest geniuses the movement has produced, Dr. Russell Thacker Troll. He was an inquiring, methodical mind that ever sought the rationale and scientific basis for the concepts and findings developed by his predecessors. Thus, he brought the hygienic system to a standard that could thoroughly challenge the medical system. Dr. Thrall delivered a lecture in the Smithsonian Institute to some of the nation's highest dignitaries in 1863. The title of the lecture was The True Healing Art. It made quite a ripple during the time, Dr. Trail is the originator of the famous challenge which, though oft repeated, has never been accepted by a single physician unto this day. This challenge is stated below. 1. That the medical system is entirely false, that it is untrue in philosophy, absurd in science, in opposition to nature's natural principles, contrary to common sense, disastrous in results, and a curse to humanity. 2. That the hygienic system is true, that it is in harmony with nature, in accord with the principles of vital organic existence, correct in science, sound in philosophy, in agreement with common sense, successful in results, and a blessing to mankind. The new system of health did not discriminate against women. In fact, it encouraged women to participate in the movement on an equal footing with men. Among the notable women in this new movement were such luminaries as Florence Nightingale, Mary Gove, Harriet Austin, Susanna May Dodds, Ellen White, and in brackets, Guiding Light of the Seventh-day Adventists, and Louisa May Alcott, the famous author whose brother became an MD and a hygienic professional. In the 1870s, the medical profession adopted the Pasteurian germ theory with a passion. Pasteurian. People found it much easier to blame their problems on little mysterious beasties rather than on their mode of living. No matter what they did, they were absolved of responsibility for their condition. The germ theory made them unfortunate victims of malevolent entities over which they could exercise little control. With the ushering in of the germ era came about the decline of hygiene. While the philosophy remains alive and still receives a good following, it has been a continual decline relative to our population. In recent years, there has been growth in the ranks of those practicing hygiene in their lives, but there are yet only a few thousand devoted hygienists. The revival of natural hygiene in the 1920s owed much of its impetus to the efforts of Bernard McFadden and Dr. Herbert M. Shelton. Though there were some great hygienists in the early part of this century, notably Hugh Ward Carrington, Otto Kark, John H. Tilden, and Linda Burfield Hazard, Dr. Shelton became the acknowledged voice of the heart of hygiene with the publication of his immortal book, Human Life, Its Philosophy and Laws, in 1927. Though Dr. Shelton built upon the shoulders of his predecessors, he produced such a wealth of literature with new findings and thoughts that he added more to the science and art of healthful living than any other person. He had the benefit of new findings, and his fertile mind generated a new body of knowledge based on them. Today, the hygienic movement still survives, though it cannot be said that it thrives. A few thousand Americans practice it conscientiously. A greater multitude pay lip service to it and practice healthier living because of it. But by and large, hygiene is almost completely out of the mainstream on the American health scene. In this lesson, we cannot hope to more than summarily deal with hygiene's history. Books on the history of hygiene are practically non-existent. It must be picked up in fragments here and there from books and magazines that make reference to the past. You'll pick up the history of hygiene throughout your studies. Perhaps someday a history will be published. And as a part of the lesson, there is an absolute huge amount of questions and the articles from Dr. Shelton, which I probably might just finish off the video with these articles. The Return to Perfection by Dr. Herbert Shelton. Our word health is derived from the Saxon word for whole. Heal is derived from the same word and means to restore to a state of wholeness, soundness, integrity. Holy comes from the same root and signifies wholeness and purity of mind. Taken in its fullness of meaning, health means completeness and perfection of organization, fitness of life, freedom of action, harmony of functions, vigor and freedom from all stain and corruption. In a phrase, it is a sound mind in a sound body. Condition of perfection. Health is a condition of perfect development, a state of wholeness and harmonious development, and a growth and adaptation of part to part of the organism, of organ to organ, with no part stunted and no part in excess. In this state of organic development lies the perfection and symmetry of beauty. Beauty is but the reflection of wholeness, of health. It is easy to demonstrate that the forms and proportions of man and of every animal and plant, which are in the highest and most useful state, are the most beautiful. This was actually quoted in the part I've already read out. When every bone is of the best form and size for its service in the total organism, there is perfect proportion. When every muscle is fully and proportionately developed with just enough fat in the cellular tissues to round out the muscles, we have the highest beauty of form. When the texture of the skin is finest and the circulation of the blood most vigorous, the blood well nourished and free of all waste, there is a glow and charm of the finest complexion. The highest beauty is the expression of the highest health. Beauty fades with a lot of health, with the loss of health. Partial beauty, fading beauty, decaying beauty, these are but expressions of partial fading or decaying health. They represent unsatisfactory and painful states of existence. Beauty belongs to glowing health and perfection of organism. It says organization, but I'm sure it says it should be organism. It is impossible for us to separate these ideals. We cannot picture health in terms of the conventional, for contemporary man is far short of this wholeness, says organization, of organization and vigor of function that is health. A picture of health. If we try to picture health, what do we see? A form of perfect symmetry and proportion, a clean, smooth, semi-transparent skin with the red blood shining through, especially in the cheeks and ends of the fingers and toes, glossy hair that is full of life, clear, bright eyes that are full of expression and dance with life, rosy lips that smile with the joys of life, pearly white, sound, even teeth, a breath that is sweet, that is as sweet as that of a flower in springtime, freedom from disagreeable body odors, indeed, where health is perfect, emitting an agreeable aroma, a body that is filled with activity, delighting in work or exercise, and a happy, courageous, mirthful, and hopeful disposition, and a desire to help others. Such a picture of health can come only from the orderly, regular, and perfect performance of the functions of life, from a sound heredity, a congenial environment, and conduct that conforms with the constitutional nature of man. Health is the perfect combination of bodily organization, intellectual energy, and moral power in harmonious unity. It means perfect organization of brain and nerves that are finely proportioned as the bones and muscular system. In a healthy person, we would expect to see the symmetry and proportion of head of the Cro-Magnon, not the asymmetry or disproportion of head of modern man. And a perfect instrument, perfect in every respect, as every organ of the body is essential to the wholeness and integrity of structure and vigor of function, no organ can be spared. Not merely must the nutritive and drainage systems be perfectly adapted to the requirements of the brain and body, but the smallest and apparently least important parts of the body must be harmoniously and fully developed. As Dr. Nichols so well expressed it, the smallest instrument out of tune brings discord into the harmony of life. How is such a high state of health to be attained? How may we assure wholeness and fullness of development, vigor of function and disease, and freedom from disease and suffering? How may man be returned to that soundness and integrity of structure and vigor and force of life that he knew in the morning of his existence? If contemporary man is so lacking in health that he is but a puny specimen of manhood, how can he be restored to his pristine power and majesty? In a word, how may man be healed? Living in accord with natural law produces perfect health. It should not require argument to convince the intelligent man and woman that those can be done only on a basis of law, natural law specifically, upon a basis of those laws that operate to make human life possible. All laws operate to make human life possible. All laws essential to the welfare of man are written in his own constitution. Every rule of human conduct to be valid in promoting human welfare and happiness must be in harmony with his nature. No law, no social custom, convention, no moral precept can have any reality to man that does not accord with his highest welfare. If it is not intimately related to man's highest fitness, physical, moral, and intellectual, it cannot correspond to his highest ideals of truth, duty, and enjoyment. The unperverted instincts of wild animals living in their natural homes are the laws of their lives. There seems to be no reason to doubt that man's instincts were once equally perfect guides in his ways of life. But if this was ever true, it certainly is not so today. Man's instincts have been so smothered and buried beneath a layer of cultural baggage that they no longer constitute reliable guides to him in his way of life. They have been conditioned until they are misguides. Health-sapping perversions begin early in life. Nonetheless, it is true that even now, instincts are fairly reliable guides to conduct in the young. But we begin the process of perverting these instincts almost from birth. Instinct does not leave us unwarned when we take our first smoke, but social usage demands that we ignore the warnings and suppress the vigorous protests of instinct. We must learn to smoke, even now that we are aware that the end may be death from lung cancer. Today, we may get our first smoke secondhand as mere infants. Smoking in the house has become almost universal. Many babies are sickened and even killed by the unintelligent practice of fathers and mothers filling the house with the poisonous fumes of burning tobacco. We are not left unwarned by our first effort to develop alcoholism. The first drink of beer is obnoxious. Wine both smells and tastes fermented, and it is. The first drink of brandy or whiskey burns and bites. It smarts and stings as it goes down. There is a protest every inch of the way. But we ignore these protests. We disregard these warnings. We are determined to grow up. And the only way this can be done in our society is to become an addict of one or more kinds. Bad practices produce human wrecks. Coffee and tea are reproaches to both our sense of smell and to our sense of taste. They produce a high state that should not be mistaken for vigour and well-being. They interfere with sleep, keeping us awake for hours. But we ignore these warnings of the faithful sentinels of life. We suppress the urge to flee from such poisons. We are determined to belong. We want to be one of the gang, even if we have to wreck ourselves in the process. We've learned to take the miserable fragments of natural foods with which the food processors and refiners have flooded the market, fragments that lack all appeal to our gustatory sense, and to add sweetening, colourings, flavourings, etc., to make them appeal to the senses of sight, smell, and taste, in spite of their unfitness to serve the needs of human nutrition. We eat them, little thinking that they do not represent true foods, or that they may prove to be actually harmful. We have found ways to get unfit substances by the guards that stand at the entrance of the Alvine Canal. We have found ways to deceive ourselves and to wreck ourselves without knowing that we are doing it. Disciplined, correct life practices will restore pristine perfection. For the evils of ignorance, the remedy is knowledge. For the evils of false ideas, the remedy is truth. For the source and of truth and knowledge, we have nature, especially human nature. Only when truth and knowledge are universal can we expect men and women to cease injuring and destroying themselves in riotous indulgence in tobacco, alcohol, and foodless food. In the spread of natural hygiene lies the hope in the future. There is another article there, but it's also extremely long, and I'm going to finish the video here. Please discern all of this information. It's I believe this was written decades ago. With the next video, I'll give you the exact date if I can when he wrote this. But I've learned a lot from it. It's taught me a lot. I have tried to follow it, and I'll be upfront, tried to follow it, become fruitarian, and raw foods only, etc. I found it really difficult. But the actual science that's involved and the research all of these people have done is without a doubt hard to basically dispute. I think a lot of it will resonate with a lot of us that we've had everything corrupted, not just what we're all going through now in life, with our cabal, our order. Anyway, love and light, and don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Hit that little notification bell so that you get the notifications for the next videos coming. I have all sorts of topics. This is a topic dear to my heart, and you know, I hesitated for a long time to put these out, but now I'm doing it because it's something I want to do, like, really seriously. Anyway, goodbye, everyone.